Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Aloha Friday, October 3rd. Today we're bringing you a show highlighting interviews with the hosts and panelists of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the NPR News Quiz Show. If you haven't heard, the show comes to Hawaii next week. We start with humorist and host Peter Sagal, who at a time was very serious about running. I first spoke with him just before he tackled the 2019 Maui Marathon. This week, he shares some regrets. We also honor host segments with funny bone panelists of the show who over the years have found their way to the islands. Alonzo Bowden tells us about changing times in comedy and making light of current events. Hari Kondabolu talks social change and his specific brand of comedy. And Paula Poundstone, did you know she was one of the original panelists when the show first came to Hawaii?
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Aloha Air Cargo, offering 5 direct flights weekly from Honolulu to Seattle Tacoma Airport. More information at AlohaAirCargo.com.
This month, join us for discussions about culture and identity with 2 Kanaka Maoli authors. Hawaii Public Radio's Live from the Atherton presents Lurleen Wailana McGregor, author of Between the Deep Blue Sea and Me, and Nikki Vandegar, author of The Invisible Wild. RSVP for these free events at hprtickets.org. Sponsored by HMSA.
Support for HPR comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits that are providing affordable housing solutions to convert renters into homeowners, such as Hawaiian Community Assets. NareitHawaii.com.
Tune to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Today, we're highlighting interviews with the voices behind the weekly NPR quiz show, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. On October 9th and 10th, host Peter Sagal will take the stage at the Neil Blaisdell Concert Hall to tape a show for a future broadcast. Sagal wrote a book about the sport of running, The Incomplete Book on Running. The host of the popular radio show ran the Maui Marathon 6 years ago. We caught up with him this week, and we lamented that the COVID pandemic scuttled plans for their Hawaii visit back in 2019.
As far as I'm concerned, that was the worst thing that happened during the pandemic, really. I mean, when you really sort of stack up the losses, I think our inability to go to Honolulu was really up there. No, it was among many other things. It was something we all missed out on and regretted it and, you know, raised our fists to the skies and cursed fate. But we are very, very glad that we are able to finally make it back to Honolulu. In fact, this will be the first time since, my gosh, 2001? When we were last there, it's been an awfully long time.
Well, we are glad that you will be here. And the last time we chatted, you were preparing, I think, for the Maui Marathon.
Yeah, although apparently, as I remember, that was in 2019. And thinking about how I did in that marathon, I did not prepare enough. Perhaps you folks and you listeners aren't aware of this, but it's very warm where you live. And they start the Maui Marathon, bless them, at 5 in the morning to get in some miles before the heat comes up. But the heat comes up, and I have never felt – chemists have a word for, like, when substances change their status from, like, liquid to gas. I was in that, you know, transformation when I finally crossed the finish line. I think that another few miles, and I would have just vanished in a puff of spray.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you survived. I've only done a marathon twice, and once was to see if I could do it. And the second time, it was to get myself back, because I just really remember the line from Mr. Rolling Stone, you can only let yourself go if you can get yourself back. So I got myself back.
Yeah, good for you.
But there was a high price to pay.
Yes. It is an awfully long way to run. Can we just agree on that?
Yes.
That is just like a long way. My goodness, whose idea was that?
I was going to ask if you were going to do the Honolulu Marathon this year, because we have got some record entries, and it sounds like you may not be training.
I am not. I continue to run. For those of you who know that about me or have followed me from Runner's World or my book about running, I'm still at it. I'll probably do it as long as my knees hold out. But I did this, how best to put this? I made a terrible mistake. I had children again. I have small children now at my age. And I'm desperately, those of us who are fortunate enough to have a chance to like get a second chance at something in life, like being a parent, you at least tend to do your best not to repeat all the mistakes you made the first time. And one of the mistakes I made the first time was like constantly zipping off to do 3-hour runs in the morning or fly to places to do marathons. So I'm not doing that now. I'm not making my kids middle-aged athlete orphans. So no marathons on the horizon right now. But I don't know. Honolulu is quite tempting.
I was really intrigued to learn that running is seeing a resurgence with the younger crowd, which I think accounts for the record numbers of entries this year.
Yeah, I think it was my book, frankly. I think, although my book only sold a moderate number of copies, I think that it must be. What else could it be? Obviously, my influence, because as everyone knows, the youth love listening to dad jokes and NPR. So I'm an influencer, I think. Let's just admit it.
Yes. And on your second chance with kids, children keep you young.
Basically, they have to because I'm not allowed to lie down and have a rest, though I'd better be young. Yeah, mainly these days I train instead of trying to run marathons. I train so I can make it through a day with my 4 and my 2-year-old without collapsing. That's the goal. That's the medal. So that's what I'm working towards.
My favorite thing is when we interview some CEO of some big company in the morning, and then I run into them at the grocery store with their toddler in tow, and the toddler is in charge.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yes. Oh, they don't care. They don't care. Oh, yeah. They know who's boss. And oh, yeah, my toddler. Well, technically, I think I have now a toddler and a preschooler.
Oh,
but they absolutely know who's boss.
I hope your family will be traveling with you.
I wish they were too. They're not going to come this time. We have brought them to Hawaii. We were in Maui with them a couple of years ago. But as everyone in Hawaii knows, that trip back to the mainland especially can be a little bit brutal on children. So we're going to wait, I think, a little bit before when they're a little bit older before we try that again, as much fun as it was the first time.
What are you looking forward to with this show?
Oh my gosh. For one thing, I understand Hawaii is nice this kind of year. No, I love Hawaii. I have been there a dozen times over the years. I'm very excited because after we spend the time in Honolulu and doing 2 shows on the 9th and the 10th of this month, I get to go to the Big Island for a day or two with Hawaii Public Radio to do an event with them there. And I have never been to the Big Island. So I will finally check off my 4th major Hawaiian island. I'm very excited about that.
Oh, gosh. You are going to God's country. So you will have the time of your life.
Oh, I know. And I'm very excited about that. And I still run. So I'm very excited to run around the island on Oahu while I'm there. I'm going to visit. Interestingly, I guess this isn't that uncommon these days and age, but I have a friend in Hawaii who I've never actually met. And that's the author Chris McDougall, who wrote the great book Born to Run. And he and I have been friendly for many years and have done virtual events together. But I'm going to go join him at his home on Oahu while I'm there and go for a run with him. And I'm excited about that. And I'm just, you know, the great thing about Hawaii is you can go there and have the best, most exciting, most amazing and memorable time doing nothing, just being there. And I am very, very much looking forward to that. Also, when I was in Honolulu last time, I had the finest dim sum of my life in Honolulu. So I am looking forward to that again.
It's really fun because I remember going to a Bill Cosby show and he was just ecstatic about some dish that he had at a Chinese restaurant. So it's fun when people discover a wonderful meal on this trip.
Yes. And no, it's amazing. And of course, I will be enjoying as much as my heart can stand it. One of my favorite foods of all time, spam musubi. Love it. I make it at home. I do. I even have a little spam musubi mold, but it's not the same unless it has been under a heat lamp in a Hawaiian convenience store for at least an hour. So it just gets that delicious tang. So I'm very much looking forward to that.
Well, my favorite place, they fry it in panko, and that just, it's
ooh,
over the moon.
Ooh, that's really good. Ooh. Okay, sorry.
That's okay. I was going to ask you how you keep your show fresh, but boy, with all the news, man.
Yeah, it's tough these times when nothing much interesting is happening. You know what's interesting, though, that there is so much happening. God knows. Lord knows. I don't need to tell anybody, especially if they're listening to Hawaii Public Radio. But a lot of times we see our job as much as distracting people from the serious news going on, as well as making fun of that news. We feel like we serve a dual purpose. You know, it's like sometimes the value I think of our show is we get to say the things on the radio or to an audience about the major stories in the news that most people just shout at their radio. We actually get to say them on the radio. That's pretty cool. But doing dad jokes and silly studies and animals stuffed in pants can also be a great boon and balm to the soul in times like this. At least that's what people tell me. And speaking for myself, I kind of agree. It's nice that I get to spend as much time thinking about all the silly stuff that's going on to take my mind off the more serious stuff.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's cathartic, right? It's a therapy for all of us. So if you can get us laughing and distract us from crying, I think that's a good thing. Well, you know, I'm looking forward to seeing everybody on Thursday, which is when I'm going to go. So you've got Taimani Gardner on Thursday and Carissa Moore on Friday.
That's indeed the case. We're very excited about both of them. Yeah.
Well, gosh, I don't know. Any final thoughts you want to leave our audience with? I mean, gee, today is day one of the government shutdown.
Yeah, I know. Well, tell you what. So my crew and I, we're going to be, because it's such a long trip and well, you know, because we're going to be in Honolulu for most of the week. And I've only been to Honolulu once, that time almost 20 years ago, or more than 20 years ago, excuse me. So if any of your listeners, you know, have hot tips on where to eat or what to do around Honolulu that my friends and I just cannot miss, you know, in addition to all the classics, by all means, let us know. You know, we're on all the platforms. We're on Facebook at Wait Wait. We're on TikTok now at Wait Wait NPR. So, you know, get in touch. Let us know. Tell us the thing that you know because you live there that we wouldn't know about. And maybe even it's just the best place to get spam musubi.
Okay, so I have given my tip for best place for spam musubi. Peter Sagal and company will be here in the islands next week for two shows at the Neil Blaisdell Concert Hall. Ukulele virtuoso Taimani Gardner will be the special guest on the 9th and Olympic surfer Carissa Moore on the 10th. Hope to see you there. Alonzo Bowden came through Honolulu this past June, performing for one night in Waikiki. Many radio listeners may recognize Bowden as a regular on NPR's weekend quiz show, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. The Conversation's D.W. Gibson talked to Bowden about how comedy has changed since he got into the business and how the popular radio show finds humor in current events.
I used to be in aerospace. That was my first career. I was an airplane mechanic. And then I got a job training mechanics. I could always be funny, but I had never been in front of people. So when I started teaching and I was in front of the class, a situation that makes most people nervous was actually the most natural thing in the world for me. So I was a very funny aircraft instructor and decided I would try comedy. And I took this comedy writing class and I did my 5 minutes, and it was at the same time I was being laid off, which is the nature of the aerospace business. You get laid off all the time. So after the 5 minutes, I was hooked, and I made a deal with myself to never work on airplanes again. And so far, I've been able to maintain that, but I do still have a toolbox in my garage.
So you've performed your comedy in various places around the world, but we know you so well from public radio. Did you grow up listening to public radio, or is that something that came later in life for you?
Well, the story with Wait Wait is very funny because I did listen to NPR. I'm a news junkie. That's just a natural thing. I grew up reading two newspapers a day. We got a morning and an afternoon paper, and it was just a thing to read the news and know what was going on. When I was invited to do Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, I had never heard of the show. I had no idea what it was. My agent told me, it's a news quiz show that's a panel of three. You got to be funny. So I get there, and I looked at the panel, and I said, oh, so I only got to be funnier than Tom Baudet. With no disrespect to Tom Baudet, I was pretty confident I could do it. And I did it, and it just fit. And Peter Sagal after I did my first show, he said, that was one of the best first shows we ever had. And I think it was one of those things of me not knowing what it was, so I wasn't at all nervous.
I love that story. One can't ever argue against doing your homework, but there's something about bringing fresh perspective and not bringing some sort of weight of what you're supposed to do in that setting and just sort of letting your own natural instincts come out in terms of what kind of comedy you want to do.
I'll tell you, I have a friend, and jazz is my love and my passion, and through the jazz cruises and other work, I've worked with a ton of jazz musicians. Marcus Miller, jazz bassist, is a good friend of mine, and when he got the call to work with Miles Davis, he said he was in a session. They said it was Miles on the phone. He was like, it ain't Miles. Miles ain't played for years. And then he said Miles cussed him out on the phone, and that's when he knew it was Miles. And he had to get right over there and play this song. And he played it, and Miles liked it. And he ended up getting in Miles' band and working with Miles. And he said, listen, if I knew the night before I had to play with Miles Davis, I'd have been a mess. He said, just, you caught me in the moment. It's the same thing with Wait. If you had told me beforehand, you know, this is one of NPR's biggest shows, there's 5 million listeners a week, and Tom Hanks is a guest host, and all, I'd have been in my head thinking about it. It was perfect not knowing what I was walking into, because then there's no pressure.
And you just bring what you bring, and it worked. That's fantastic. I love that story.
I seem to have fooled them.
Well, I'm curious, what's the general approach to addressing, let's say, some of the harder truths of the world? Do you all have a sense of how you're going to handle the banter around the politics of any given week before you go on stage, or is there some free range there?
Well, here's the thing. Only one Trump joke per show, because it becomes so repetitive and boring, and it's the same thing over and over, the ridiculousness, you know, he'll tweet something in the middle of the night. If you just started doing that, that would dominate the show. So they kind of have an unwritten rule of only one Trump joke per show.
So there's always a panel for every show, and sometimes there are guest panelists and so forth, but there's a cohort of regulars on the show. And I wonder, you know, for all of us listening, it's this auditory experience of all of the back and forth. Let us inside a little bit. Are there any sort of visual cues you have between each other? Do you sort of know each other's rhythms really well at this point in terms of when to jump in and how to keep the conversations going?
Well, some people you know, and then other people you just pick up on it. So, for example, Paula is Paula, and Paula is going to keep going and going until you stop Paula. So we know that. So you can always jump in with Paula. Mo Rocca, who's Mo, is my absolute favorite because Mo has this weird circular logic when he's figuring out an answer. He starts at A and he goes through the entire alphabet to get back to A and then gives his answer. So I know that he's going to do that. Faith Saley, what you don't hear on the radio, just dirty. Just the woman's filthy. It's comical. And so, and I probably have some things that they would tell you about me. I always say that Paul is a singles hitter and I'm swinging for the home run. I'm waiting to hit the 3-run homer. That, I think, is the biggest difference between she and I. So, yeah, we kind of get to know each other and get to learn each other's rhythms on the show.
And now, panel, I have some questions for you about this week's news. Alonzo, you've heard of Real ID. Well, this week, the TSA released an advisory reminding people that they cannot get on flights using what?
As someone who flies all the time, this one even surprised me. You cannot fly using your Costco card.
That's right. Have you tried?
No, but I read the story and I was like, I can't believe they're doing, you know, I have all of it. You know, I have Clear, I have TSA PreCheck. In other words, I travel all the time. I'm getting through the airport. If I have to wait for you because you broke out a Costco card, we're gonna have a problem.
Plus, when you get off the plane, they go through your whole receipt, just checking that the flight was okay, which is a major time killer. Where my Costco head's at?
So we don't know where it's going. I think the biggest misconception is people think we have some idea of the show. We actually don't. The only thing we know in advance is the bluff, the listener story we get the day before, because two of us are going to have to write fake stories. But other than that, we don't know. And my favorite thing is there's always some question that I have no idea what they're talking about. You know, a naked man grocery shopping in Germany. I had that one time. I'm like, was I supposed to know about that? Last week, we had a question about the poles on the sun. Did you know the sun has a north and south pole? Because I certainly didn't, nor did anyone sitting. Nobody knows that. And they're at, it's like, what do you stop it? You know, so there's always those questions. I learned a long time ago, it is more important to be funny than to be right.
Absolutely. In this case, funny definitely takes precedent over right in the land of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. And you have a robust career outside of the confines of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. You've been doing stand-up for a very long time. And, you know, the world has changed a great deal since you first started doing stand-up. How has stand-up changed in that time? Since you first began, how has the art form of stand-up changed?
Well, I've been doing it 32 years, and obviously the biggest change has been social media. First with MySpace. By the way, when I did Last Comic Standing, I had more MySpace friends than you could shake a stick at, and unfortunately, they're all gone now. Yeah, then YouTube, and from now it's more TikTok is probably the dominant thing. So maybe the attention span has shortened. Someone asked me about a stand-up show on TV, and it's like, that would never work now because everyone just goes to TikTok or Instagram, and us old people go to Facebook, and you look for the comic you want, and you see their clips. So that's the big change in how it's consumed. I just missed the Johnny Carson era, which was, you know, in the 80s, if you were on Johnny and Johnny invited you to the couch, you were set. That was it. So basically, I was too young for Johnny and too old for social media. But that's the big change in stand-up. The other thing, this whole thing about the cancel culture is just so overblown. I've been trying, let me tell you something. If there's anything you guys can do to help me get canceled, I appreciate it. Because every time I see Dave Chappelle get canceled, I watch him do another $10 million special. And I just want one of those. So if you could do anything to get me canceled, I'd appreciate it. I'd love a $10 million deal from Netflix because I was canceled. People talk about the language and the, how should I put it, the sensibility of comedy changing. In other words, things you made fun of in the 90s, you're not going to make fun of today. And it's like, well, yeah, but that's true of all society. Like everything in society, the language has changed. The narratives have changed. The acceptance of various people, the acknowledgement of various things has changed. So stand-up changes with them and in a lot of ways changes ahead of them. And then other things, unfortunately, stay the same. It is a sad reflection of our society that everything George Carlin said is more true now than then.
Yeah, some of the stuff that stays evergreen, it's a little sad that it stays evergreen and relevant.
Oh, there was a period when I was really getting tired. I became a topical comic probably after Last Comic Standing. And then I got tired of it because we won't change. I'm still doing racism jokes. My jokes about our healthcare system being broken still work. The dumbing down of America is still happening. So I wish I didn't talk about those things. I wish I could say something about not having health insurance and people saying, what, are you crazy? Instead of, yeah, I feel that, you know. So it sucks. It sucks that our society doesn't move.
That was comedian Alonzo Bowden talking with HBR's D.W. Gibson. This interview originally aired this past spring. Fun fact, Bowden's first Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me appearance was in Chicago's Chase Auditorium 15 years ago, almost to the day, October 2nd, 2010. If you're just joining the conversation, we're airing a Hannah Ho show with the talent herd weekends on the popular NPR show Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Stay with us. We'll be right back after a break.
Support for HPR comes from HMSA, for over 87 years committed to working together with employers, partners, and healthcare providers to support the health and well-being of the community. Learn more at hmsa.com.
Join us on Saturday, October 4th at 2 p.m. for an intimate event from HPR's Live from the Atherton and The Moth. Learn more about crafting your story from director and producer of The Moth, Michelle Jalowski. Seating in our Atherton studio is limited. Tickets are available at hprtickets.org.
KHPR Honolulu, KKUA Wailuku, KANO Hilo, KHPH Kailua Kona, KIPL Lihue, and KJHF Kuala Pu'u.
This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. We're sharing a Hanaho program featuring interviews with the voices heard on the NPR News quiz show, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. The show will be coming to the Blaisdell Concert Hall next Thursday and Friday. It was almost 6 years ago that New York-based comedian Hari Kondabolu came through Hawaii, headlining gigs on Maui and Oahu. He joined us in studio to talk story about his brand of comedy.
I started in comedy when I was like 17, 18. I was in high school, and it's something I always loved to do. I started doing comedy before I became a socially aware or politically active person. And, you know, after college, I was working at an immigrant rights organization. This is like 2005, a few years after 9/11, after the backlash. So I was working with victims of hate crimes and working with refugees and people who were being detained and deported. So it was heavy stuff. My boss at the time actually was Pramila Jayapal, who's now a congressperson out of Seattle. But, you know, I did comedy at night. It was a young scene in Seattle, a healthy scene, and I did it for fun, and it was something I didn't expect to be a career, because how many South Asians were in the media at the time? How many South Asians were in films and TV? How many South Asians were doing stand-up? So, you know, I didn't see myself as someone breaking any barriers, and so I did it for fun, and I had this job that I absolutely loved, and next thing I knew, I get discovered, I get to be on TV, I have a manager, and, you know, that was about 12 years ago now, and all of a sudden, more than 12, probably 13 years ago now, and you know, I've been doing it ever since, full time.
Okay, so what did your parents say?
Well, you know what? Here's the thing about that. Like, if I had started straight out of college doing stand-up, I think they would have freaked out, but I played it smart where I went to grad school and got a master's from London School of Economics. I'd had a job before and was on TV twice before I said to them, I think I'm going to pursue stand-up. So as long as you're able to get a graduate degree,
yes,
and
show your parents
and be on TV multiple times to prove to them that this is a viable profession, then it's a little easier to be like, okay, he's not going to be a doctor.
Yeah. And so this isn't your first trip to Hawaii.
No, this is my second. That's why I wanted to come back. And I did an artist in residency with the Shangri-La Museum, you know, the Doris Duke Museum. And I did a show with my brother last time I was here, our Kondabolu Brothers podcast, as well as a stand-up show. And I just loved it so much. I was just obviously in awe of the place, just shocked by the history. Also, the context is so different. Like, to, you know, throughout the mainland, it's like I'm a visible minority, and it's you know, it's a white majority country and the white majority area, and then to come to Hawaii and then all of a sudden not feel like I'm in the minority in the same way is a remarkable feeling. You know, to actually not feel like an outsider in my own country, like, I was just in awe of that feeling. And so, You know, in addition to the fascinating history here, as someone who talks about history a lot in my act and colonialism, I mean, this place is ripe with discussions of that. And so I'm just like, you know, to me, this was such a wonderful place. I was actually surprised people even came to my show last time. Just I'm like, it's so beautiful here. Why would you want to see somebody talk? Like, I, you know, if I had the choice between going to the beach and seeing somebody talk, I'd go to the beach. Right? Not to say you shouldn't come see me at the Blue Note tonight at 6:30 at 9. I'm just saying that, you know, if for me, I can't imagine wanting to be indoors. But I also know if you live here, it's probably a little different.
Yeah. You know, and because the mainland is a long ways away, it's really cool when we've got good acts in town, you know, to support that. So we get the pipe, keep the pipeline going.
Yeah. No, I mean, this is, I mean, for I think any artist, this is a dream gig. And it's one that, you know, I feel like I've been here a few days. I did a show in Maui. I'm relaxed. Now the only thing is justify the trip by having a good show.
Like, make people laugh.
Make sure you do your job. And I feel pretty confident just because, like, audiences here are extremely attentive and thoughtful and smart. And the experience I've had from my Maui show and from the last time I was here, like, I feel pretty good about it.
Well, I know in one of your bits you talk about how you look like a Muppet working on a PhD. And I was thinking, oh, you've grown a beard since. So you look more like from Cheech and Chong.
Right, a little more like Tommy. Well, I mean, to be fair, the rest of that joke was also about how handsome I am despite that. So that just for full context. Yeah, I mean, like, my style is very professorial. Like, I know that. And for some people, it's like, what's going on? But I do feel like there's punchlines in it. There's tons of jokes in it. So it's just a matter of, like, if you can set through me, you know, be there for me setting it up, you'll get the reward at the end. So I like a patient, thoughtful audience.
And so how are you treated as you go from place to place? I mean, people aren't sure what nationality you are, or how does that work?
You know, it's gotten better. I mean, certainly when I started in, like, 2005, 2006, I think there was a curiosity of seeing me on stage telling jokes without an accent. You know what I mean? We're talking, it's not even that long ago to me,
right.
But
you look like a terrorist, but
right, like post 9/11, right? And I didn't even have a beard back then. So, like, the stereotypes, also, like, confronting them when you're on stage is hard, or even having to address what are you within the first minute of being on stage, because that's the elephant in the room for people, is like, why does he look like that? Why is he talking like that? My brother says that during those days, it was almost, for a lot of people, it must have been like seeing a dog talk. Like, you couldn't even imagine the possibility, you know, aside from, oh, also they're going to entertain us. Like, just the idea this person is talking and sharing their experience, first generation who is, you know, born here and actually, you know, being able to share their experiences the way I did, and you know, Aziz and Mindy Kaling and Hasan Minhaj and that first wave did. So, you know, I feel like, yeah, like, now it's a little less like that. I feel like it's less of a shock to see me on stage. And I think the issues I'm dealing with more now is, you know, as much as I'm touring the country all over the place and being able to perform in the American, you know, in the South and on the coasts and in the middle of the country and taking risks, I'm still, you know, dealing now post-Trump with some people not handling it as well. Like, I was in Ann Arbor, Michigan, which is a very liberal place. Middle of one of my shows, a guy stood up and yelled, "Hail Trump." Mm. And just the idea that the word Trump is used as a threat, you know, it's very pregnant, has a great deal of meaning in it. And so, you know, that's the new struggle now, the idea of people trying to silence voices of color and people whose points of view historically have been marginalized.
I remember as a kid, my first trip to the mainland, I was 11, and I was riding my cousin's bicycle, and someone yelled out in the truck, "Get off the road, you dirty little Mexican." And I was like, "I'm not Mexican." And then come to find out, you know, you do your DNA, I'm Native American. So it's like, I guess he was right, but I don't think I was dirty that day.
And I don't think he thought about it that much. It's never like, you know, when people say, "Go back to your country," they're not, that sometimes I think you're only saying that because you don't know what country my heritage is from. But yeah, I mean, that's why, you know, I feel like being on stage and sharing your truth is so important, because that might be the only perspective people have. And so I take the responsibility seriously to share my truth and to be honest up there. And because, like, I remember a time where there were no voices. We just had a Pooh from The Simpsons. And so for me, this is all icing on the cake.
We've been having a good time here talking to comedian Hari Kondabolu. This interview originally aired back in 2019. Paula Poundstone made her debut as a Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me panelist in 2001. The following year, when the NPR News Quiz made its way to Hawaii, Poundstone was one of the panelists, along with Sue Ellicott and Adam Felber. We should note that during the show, Poundstone did not get a single question correct in the lightning fill-in-the-blank portion of the quiz. Poundstone has been celebrated as a one-of-a-kind performer and voice actor, and Honolulu has been part of her comedy tour in recent years. When she spoke with The Conversation Savannah Harriman-Pote in 2022, the comedian said if she were to do it all over again, she wouldn't be called Paula Poundstone at all.
No, the truth is I've never liked my name. I would have loved to have changed my name. I guess I just didn't think of it in time.
For this interview, I can call you something different. We can workshop it.
Well, you know, when I was a kid, I don't know how old, like probably 4 or 5 or so, I used to insist that people call me Lipstick Nancy. I had a cousin named Nancy and I had a babysitter named Nancy, and they both had long blonde hair. And, you know, I had curly brown hair. And so the grass is always greener. And they were both very beautiful. So to me, that was a sign of beauty. And then I always liked red lipstick. And so I felt the combination of the two would make a beautiful name. My siblings called me Popeye, but they didn't call me Lipstick Nancy. But I'm over it now. I have one kid whose middle name is Kat. And she used to tell people, she was very embarrassed of that. I don't know why. It's a great name, but she used to tell people that it was short for Catherine. It's not, but I do believe she's part cat. It could be the way she licks her hands. I have 10 cats, and while my children were growing up, we always had lots. I did just have my, I have 2 big dogs, and one of them was just diagnosed with congenital heart disease. And so what they did was, they inserted a tube into my bank account and drained it. That seemed to help the dog.
Who watches all the animals while you're out on the road?
A woman works for me that she started as my nanny. That was just after my middle daughter was born. And so she's worked for me for 28 years. So I must have done something right.
Now, I wonder, when you, because you spend so much time just in your line of work, jetting through different cities, when you are in so many different environments, are there routines that you do in each place to make them feel more familiar?
I think I'm very bear-like when I travel. I become so unbelievably sedentary that every place feels familiar to me because it's all pretty much the same hotel room after a while. And I'm only in a town for one night generally. Every now and then there's some place I'll do for 2 nights. And the place I do for 2 nights, I may actually walk around outside. But for the most part, I live a very sedentary life on the road. So if I had one of those step counters, I don't even need a step counter. I can just do it in my head. I took 5.
You and your shows, though, interact so closely with the audience and really bring them into the stories that you're telling. That's one of the things that you're known for. Do you feel like you get a sense of what a city or place is like just from the cadence of those interactions?
Maybe in a very nuanced kind of a way. When I work in Maine, I often look out across a sea of gray hair. People in Maine, for the most part, don't dye their hair. It doesn't mean no one does, but the women in Maine, it's not unusual. They're not older than other crowds that I perform to. They're not older than me. They just don't dye their hair. So I can tell when I'm in Maine. I love to work. No matter what state I'm in, really terrific, fun people come out to see me. I worked at the Villages in Florida, and I had no idea what it was. I didn't even know I was supposed to be working there. When I get a job, my manager calls me up. She says, are you free on such and such a night? Right. I open my calendar. I look. I say, yeah. She'll tell me the name of the city. If she tells me more information than that, I don't even write it down. I write everything down on a need to know basis. So the only thing it says in my calendar and the only thing it said for that date was Orlando. Well, I've worked Orlando before, so that didn't surprise me in any way. Well, I was doing a radio interview, like maybe a couple days before I left for this job. And it was one of those morning interviews, you know, the lawnmower and the madman in the morning. And, you know, we were making jokes and stuff. And then finally, at the end of the interview, one of the guys says to me, "Paula, why are you working at the Villages?" And I said, "What do you mean?" I'd never even heard of the place. And he explained to me that it had a reputation for, well, it's a retirement community, but it had a reputation for being very right wing. And I just laughed when he said it, because I said, I go, "Well, I guess I got my work cut out for me." And thank goodness this person told me, because otherwise it would have all come as a big shock to me. But when I got to the theater there, because they have their own theater, when I got to the theater there, I told the audience that story. They thought that was the funniest thing they'd ever heard. And I said to them, I said, "We'll just have to find the stuff that we have in common." And you know what? We had tons in common. We laughed and laughed. It was such a fun night. It's really one of my fondest performing memories. So the truth is, as much as we like to feel like we're all terribly, terribly unique and different, we're not.
Now, I wonder, because you performed over so many different mediums, you've appeared in specials, on television, in live performances, and then also for us over in radio, you are known as one of the foremost panelists on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, as well as the host of your own program, Nobody Listens to Paula Poundstone. Do you prefer interacting with a live audience in that setting, or do you like being a disembodied voice?
Oh, it's a lot more enriching to be in front of an audience. I'll tell you, Wait, Wait, over the years, because it's been on for a long, long time now, I think I've been with them for 22 years, and they were on a couple years before I showed up. When I first started doing that show, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, on NPR, we, as the panelists and the scorekeeper, which was Carl Castle, and Peter Sagal, the host, we were not even all in the same room together. We were not at our homes for the most part. We were in whatever studio, you know, NPR studio was closest to us. So Peter was in Chicago, Carl was in DC, I was in Los Angeles, Adam was in New York. I think Roy has his own studio at his house. But anyways, so there was no audience in front of us. But eventually they found a home for themselves in a performance space, not even a theater, an auditorium in the basement of a bank in downtown Chicago. And man, the difference as a performer. And we don't interact with the audience in the way that I do when I'm on stage in my regular show, except for during the break. It's an audience watching a radio show get made. But generally speaking, by the way, a firecracker hot audience. One time we did Red Rocks. We did that theater up in that amphitheater in Red Rocks. I think it was 8,500 people. And it's as if every one of them was handpicked. I mean, they were so much fun. And sometimes when you do like an enormous crowd like that, it sort of loses something in a way. It's like when you put too much oil on something you're making, you know, started out a good thing, but now when you finish, you're like, ugh. Sometimes that can happen with one of those kind of huge crowds, but these people were just perfect from start to finish. And then of course, along came COVID. First we were back in the studio and then we couldn't even do that. So then we're all in our own homes. I will say, especially after being at home for 15 months during the stay-at-home order, that when I was able to get back on stage again, one of the things that's glorious about it, and I knew this from years of experience, but one of the things that's glorious about it is being able to share with an audience in front of me, you know, how depressed I feel about this thing or that thing. Or I'll say to them, I'll go like, geez, you know, I did read where it's not uncommon during this period of COVID, not because you have or had COVID, but just from living in the stress of the COVID years, that a lot of us are suffering from memory loss. And then I'll tell them a couple of stories about that. I go, anybody? And people are like, oh yeah, I have that. And that, there's something about, I always call it the recognition laughter. There's something about stuff that's funny because you recognize what the person is talking about. And all of a sudden, that sort of yoke of I'm the only one, that is such a comfort. And then you can laugh at it. Trust me, I don't laugh a lot at home alone. if you put a glass to my hotel room door, you never hear.
When did you realize, like, oh, I'm funny? And was it before or after someone else told you you were funny?
I don't know for sure. I know I love the sound of laughter. And what's not to love? So I think I was always drawn to that. In addition to that, when I was in kindergarten, I received, they used to write summary letters as in lieu of a report card. And the first sentence of the last paragraph in the summary letter written by my kindergarten teacher, Mrs. Bump, I think it was May of 1965, I think, said, "I have enjoyed many of Paula's humorous comments about our activities." I suppose it's like you give your dog a treat because you want it to do that thing it did again. For me, getting positive feedback from an adult about something that I had done was really powerful. I don't think my mother thought I was particularly funny, so I'm sure when she read that, she was like, "What?"
Thank you so much for this conversation. I've really enjoyed it, and I hope you enjoy your hotel room when you're here, as well as the show.
I'm looking forward to it. Thank you so much.
That was comedian and Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me panelist Paula Poundstone. She spoke with the conversation Savannah Harriman-Pote back in May of 2022. Poundstone will be one of the panelists for the live taping of the show at the Blaisdell Concert Hall. Before we go, we have one last Wait, Wait connection to share. 6 years ago, the Big Island Marine Mammal Center, Kei Kaiola, made it into the national spotlight for, of all things, a butt-dialing gecko. Here's our 2018 conversation with Dr. Claire Simeon, the director of the facility, about that experience. Okay, now I think the last time I talked with you, you had something wonky happen at your facility and involved a gecko. And I believe that there were stories, across the country on the network news and internationally. But in the world of public radio, you've really made it when you're on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Oh, my gosh. I did not think that the pinnacle of my career would be a gecko story and not a marine mammal story, but it's true. You've made it when you're on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
So we have a little clip from that show. Take a listen.
Hundreds of people receive calls from an animal hospital in Hawaii thanks to a blank.
Beachwell.
A tiny gecko stepping on a phone's touchscreen.
No!
According to the hospital's director, she was worried there was some kind of emergency when she got 9 calls in a row from her work number with just silence on the other end. The calls were actually being made by a gecko whose tiny little feet were dialing up everyone on the phone's recently called list. While some people complained, most were actually really thankful for the gecko's call, which helped them save 15% or more on their phone insurance.
I just love that.
It was so fun. I think it was the story that everybody needed. It was a feel-good story, and it just cracked us up here.
And I'm surprised no calls from the Geico folks yet.
You know, the Geico gecko did retweet me on Twitter, so I think that's a win.
Yes, a win for the Geico gecko. That was Dr. Claire Simeon, director of the Marine Mammal Facility, Kei Kaiola, on the Kona Coast. To see a photo of the gecko that Peter Sagal quizzed the Wait, Wait panelists about, visit the conversation page. And that does it for us for today's Hanaho Show. Make your own memories. Join Hawaii Public Radio for two live tapings with guests Taimane and Carissa Moore. Have your own favorite guest or segment? Share it with us. Call our talkback line and leave us your comments. Here's that number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can listen back to our shows on the conversation page of our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. And you can find The Conversation as a podcast on Spotify or Apple. Our program is produced by Maddie Bender, Lillian Song, and D.W. Gibson, with support from Savannah Harriman-Pope and the HPR Digital Team. The backer theme, written for us by John DeMello, and our theme music, courtesy of Gypsy 808. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us on Monday. Pick up The Conversation.